The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And to think, in those innocent times when we were talking 24 hours ago, our biggest worry about public order was that there were a few too many people queuing up for coffee in Monkstown and texters texting about carnage in Blackrock as people rode cycling and walking. At that very time, it was all starting to kick off inside in town. So obviously that's dominating the front pages a bit today. The Sunday Times eating with Gardaí attacked in clashes with lockdown protesters. There's an interesting, they're kind of off lead there, is talking to some of these people. And there is a woman called Parker and her friend, and they're saying, we're here to protest against RTE as well. Her friend said, over 9,000 people went missing in Ireland last year. Asked how this was linked to RTE, the pair outlined a conspiracy theory that involved babies being killed and harvested for adrenochrome, which is used to keep RTE celebrities looking young while the corpses are buried underneath the new children's hospital. I can't speak for anyone else, but they told me that they were monkey glands they were giving me and that they're ethically sourced from Thailand, I believe. So that's my story and I'm sticking to it. The Irish Mail on Sunday, Gardaí hunt COVID thugs, 23 held after Gardaí attacked with fireworks at Grafton Street riot. Sunday Independent has 13 charged after violence in Dublin, but they are leading with that tragedy in Cork and the line that Gardaí intervened with the family at the centre of that murder-suicide just hours before the killing happened. They also have a story, like, never mind the crowd in town, right? This is the kind of white-collar crime then of the pandemic stuff, which is that 7,610 Irish residents who arrived back in the state between February 8th and 21st declared they were on a holiday or a visit. So that is, by my reckoning, 500 people a day are coming in, Irish people coming into Ireland every day saying that they're either visiting or they're coming home from their holidays. So there you go. I'd be as outraged about that as I would be about the riot. Sunday World, cops rang axe killer hours before murder. So that's the similar story to the Sunday Independent. Suspect Johnny Hennessy had made panicked phone call to relative about awful fighting among brothers at Cork Farm. So that's just an awful story. And the Business Post, they have a poll today and they are saying that the support for Fianna Fáil plummets is the headline. I'm going plummeting. It's down to 13 from 16, but it had gone up a few in the last poll. But 55% of voters believe the government needs to be doing far more to speed up the vaccination process. Just 23% think the government is doing a good job rolling it out as quickly as possible. And 40% worried about schools reopening. And then the tabloids, the Sun is lock clown protester. That's I don't know if you saw this footage of that protester, and he just methodically makes his way from a few lines back up to the front, holding up in the air the whatever rocket thing, the way he fired the firework at the cops, which is going to be chilling enough. Protester fires at cops in shameful scenes. And the Irish Sunday Mirror, barefaced thuggery, three Gardaí hurt and 23 arrests as anti-mask, anti-vax rally descends into violence. So there you go. Our panel today, Lise Hand, is a journalist. Rory O'Neill is a publican and an entertainer. And Kingston Mills, who joins us remotely, is Professor of Experimental Immunology at the School of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College Dublin. Good morning, everyone. You're very welcome. Lise Hand, you've been actually working on this, about these riots and stuff. You've been working kind of deep cover on this whole area of the spread. This all appears to have kicked off around Facebook groups. You've been working in this area for the last while.
Yes, Brendan. I've been working with Kinsen, which it's an Irish company that essentially looks at ways for organisations, media organisations and companies to fight disinformation and misinformation. They use, you know, algorithms and also just good old human eyeballs, journalists and so on, to create these kind of solutions. So I've been very much immersed in the world of disinformation for the last 6 months.
And this is no surprise to you?
No, this is absolutely no surprise. I mean, I've been concentrating very much on anti-vaccination groups, organisations and individuals. And I've watched this unfold in real time over the last few weeks. I've seen the groups, particularly on Facebook, promoting this this protest and others that are scheduled over the next few weeks. And, you know, quite and it's you know, it was quite blatantly there to see. And, you know, they sort of work off this. This whole notion of being patriotic, you know, they're patriots and they usually come with sort of tricolours attached, and they push this narrative very much that it's patriotic to be anti-lockdown, anti-mask and anti-vaccine. And this is really, it's a combination of things. I mean, they're not, they're hatriots. I mean, they're, you know, they're promoting, they're anti-democratic, anti-community, they're bottom feeders. They really do kind of tap into the understandable fear and anger and loneliness over a lot of the issues attached to the COVID pandemic and the lockdowns. And they promote this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that Drew Harris was sort of saying that there's far left and far right, but it's not. This is far right.
I think in fairness, he's clarified that
yeah.
this morning.
Oh, and, right. Yeah, because these are very much far right groups.
Yeah.
They are, you know, and it's very it's interesting because it is all tied into the anti-vaccine thing as well. I mean, if you looked at some of the details of the video footage from yesterday, you can see a lot of anti-vaccine signs as well. Mm. And this sort of level of disinformation is rampant all over social media, over Instagram.
But then
over
you
TikTok,
kind of feel
over Facebook,
yeah,
over
but it's,
Twitter.
Regardless of how rampant it is, I mean, I at the start of this, I thought that social cohesion would be a real problem and that order might break down. It hasn't so far. This was a few thousand people max. And, you know, there has been widespread condemnation of it. It does seem, Rory, that it's a kind of an aberration, doesn't it? That things are holding together fairly well in general.
Well, yeah, but I think in a way it's naive to think that things won't change. Because, I mean, I think you can look at America or whatever even. You know, people often have, you know, we laugh at them and think how nutty it is, and that, you know, I have to say you look wonderful on your adrenochrome, Brendan, but you know, they might seem funny, but at the same time, those people sincerely believe that. And I think in everyone's social circle now, you're beginning to see one or two anti-vaxxers pop up. That
even in your liberal, enlightened bubble that you're
no one's
in, Rory. Really?
Even in my liberal bubble.
You know people who have ideas, yeah?
Who are anti-vax for sure. Because it started, you know, they came at it from, you know, the original anti, oh, it's unhealthy and, you know, we're pushing chemicals into our bodies. This kind of hippy-dippy stuff.
Yeah.
And then that was harnessed to becoming sort of hardcore anti-vaxxer. And so it's very easy to laugh at these things now, but these things grow if they're not dealt with, you know, at an early stage. And, you know, it's sort of indicative there because you see that what they talk about there in that bit that we're laughing about the RT and all that, they are exactly QAnon talking points.
Yeah,
and,
it's, you know, America it's echoes of Pizzagate,
it's
isn't
exactly
it?
Exactly,
yeah,
Pizzagate and all that. So you can see, you know, and America sort of showed us what happens if you ignore this stuff.
Yeah. Kingston, are you troubled by this?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's happened recently, if you looked at the polls on vaccine acceptance, actually it's gone much higher. The people willing to have a vaccine is now over 85%.
Well, certainly in this country.
Yeah, in this country.
We're almost an outlier at this stage, aren't we? Because the rest of Europe, there seems to be a lot more scepticism.
And some countries like Sweden and Norway and those countries, the Scandinavian countries, are very, very pro-vaccine. In fact, would be higher than we are. I think the US is probably the country that has the lowest. The UK is also pretty high, actually. So I think that Ireland is on a par with some of the better countries now. And I think what's happened is that people have seen that the vaccines are not causing huge issues in terms of safety, and they're seeing the consequences of not having them. And people are buying into it now. So I think that vaccine acceptance is actually going to go up.
Yeah, yeah. That would seem to be the way the general gist of things is going. But I think, as Rory and Lise say, we have to watch these things as well. Lise, in terms of, I suppose, if that is the extreme end of the slight fraying of nerves that's going on, there's a fraying of nerves around the kind of mainstream body politic as well. In terms of the poll in the Business Post today, what jumped out for you there?
Well, I think the main takeout from that is that the future of any kind of this, if this government is to have a future, it is very much tied up with how they deal with coming out of lockdown and also the pace and the that they proceed with the vaccination programme as well. There's a fairly high level of disquiet over, I think, the pace of both of those. I mean, it's kind of in a way the government are damned if they do and damned if they don't, because we look at what happened at Christmas. They said we'll give everybody a Christmas, and then we were into the horror show that was January when they took the clamps off. So in a way, it's sort of trying to get that balance right. But it is very clear that how they handle the vaccination, the rollout vaccination, is going to be key to their survival. People, I think, are now pinning their hopes on that. And we can sort of talk a little later maybe about sort of the whole communications of this. But there does seem to be a sense that people are confused and not particularly sure. They're getting mixed messages. There's multiple voices talking at government level. There's ministers all contradicting each other. There's no coherent voice.
And luckily, we'll stick with the vaccination. It is. And sure, look, we all knew this from the beginning. This is the most important thing any government is going to have to do in 100 years.
I mean, I would argue that, you know, they talk a lot about the sort of the logistics of it and so on. But I think there's also what is lacking with this programme is possibly that sort of sense of urgency. I mean, all the talk has been like, this is a war situation. We're in the kind of a wartime scenario. And the sense of urgency isn't there. I would like to see a situation where when they say the vaccinations are rolled out for, we'll say, go down a bit, under 65s, that is a 24-hour rollout. I mean, I would like to sort of, you know,
I assume it will be at that point. I mean, Breon McGrath was on Katie Hannan yesterday. He was very forthcoming and very detailed, backed up with figures, what Micheál Martin had said about 80% of the adult population by June, which compares well internationally, I think. Yeah. He was talking about in quarter three, you know, we know about 1 million in quarter two, 1 million a month. He's talking about 2 million a month as we go into quarter three, and they seem confident they can do it. Kingston, there was an interesting moment yesterday when Katie Hannan put to Breon McGrath a story from The Examiner, which apparently, look, it was mixed messages. Like, I don't think The Examiner were deliberately getting things wrong, about how much of our AstraZeneca we'd used. And he said, actually, he had just gone off and checked, and we'd used 99.5% of the AstraZeneca that's in the country. And it does seem, doesn't it, that, I mean, you would have always said the worst thing that could happen here is if there's vaccines sitting around. But they are doing their stated thing of getting them into people's arms as fast as they can. 55% of people saying it's not fast enough, but that's down to supply, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, the biggest issue we've faced all with this is that people don't understand, perhaps, that we're in the hands of the manufacturers, the vaccine companies that make these vaccines, how much they can have for the whole of the world. And everybody wants them, obviously. And we're within the EU assignment of vaccines, and we get a percentage based on our population. And so I think, to be fair to the people that are rolling out the vaccine, they're getting it into people, you know, pretty quickly. I think a bigger issue for me with it is the IT systems, and that was highlighted today in the Mail, or was it
the Mail article.
Claire Scott had an article about the IT failures. We were told that we would have a system in place by the end of last year, and according to this article today, this is the Salesforce and IBM were given the contract for doing this, and they're still developing it, and now it's the end of February. So, in order to have a system that is going to do on a large scale, I mean, the numbers we're immunising right now is very small. Yeah. Let's face it.
And also, it has to be said that we need to get to. Yeah, sorry, and just to interject, and you keep talking then, but it has to be said as well that last week there were clearly a lot of problems with getting it out to GPs, and as GPs understood they were getting it, and older people having appointments cancelled and everything else. And it was messy, wasn't it?
It was messy. And, you know, I think that there are lots of teething troubles that need to be ironed out. What they're doing right now is, as I said, trivial compared with where they need to be when they really get, you know, if they get 500,000 doses of vaccine to week. I mean, Denmark have said they're probably leading the world. And a lot of aspects of how they've done this. They really have done a fantastic job. They're going to once they've got available vaccine, they're going to do a 500,000 a week. And they have a digitalized system. Everybody has an app on their phone and they're told when they have to come. The record is there of who got what vaccine. It's all integrated. We need something like that desperately here.
Yeah. Rory, would you share the frustration of that 55% of people?
I mean, sort of two months. I understand that this is a really complicated job and it's, you know, it's our first time at it. I mean, anecdotally, because my own parents, one of my parents is over 65, one is under 65.
Over 85?
Yes, 85. Yeah. Sorry. My dad's 87 and my mom is 84. So that threw up a little question in our minds. Does that mean dad's going to get vaccinated but mom won't? And then their GP was told he was getting vaccines in 2 weeks' time. So he was all prepared for that and they were. And then out of the blue, there's a knock on his door and he gets 300 vaccines delivered. So it does show that on the ground level, it is a mess, the rollout. But on the upside, both my parents got vaccinated last Tuesday.
You see, that's the side of the mess we can take if they're coming too early. I suppose this does lead us into the broader question then. I know, Rory, you were taken as well by that Irish Times poll during the week of 2/3 of the population saying that when the older people are vaccinated and the vulnerable are vaccinated, we want to get on with our lives. Yeah. Do you feel that's what people are going to demand at that point?
I mean, I think so. I mean, we're talking, there's a lot in the papers today about lockdown fatigue and all of that. And I think when it gets to a point where everybody who wants to be vaccinated is vaccinated, it's going to be very hard to argue in favour of any sort of strong restrictions. And I'd have to say, I'd have a lot of sympathy for that view because my bar has been closed for a year. I'm banging my head off the walls at this stage. The only reason we have a business still to open is because of the supports that were made available, and we have been lucky with our landlord, who, by the way, is a vulture fund. So that's an unusual one, but they've been very understanding. So I am desperate to get back to some sort of life. And the other thing, of course, is I don't expect to live my life with no risk ever. And once everybody who wants to be vaccinated has been vaccinated and we have put in place a good test and trace system, I want to get back to life.
Okay, but you're saying once everyone's been done, so maybe June, that 80%, or if it's July, if
I'm happy to wait till September, if it takes till September. I don't want to reopen until it's safe to do so. But my worry is who's deciding what that level of acceptable risk is. To me, once everybody who's been vaccinated, who wants to be, is willing to be vaccinated, I want us to return to a normal life.
Kingston, what do you think about that notion? And there will be a clamour for this, that once we were protecting the old and the vulnerable was the line and protecting the hospital system. And once the old and the vulnerable are done, 2/3 of people are saying, well, we want to get back to life then. Is that a recipe for disaster?
The major issue is the variants, because if we didn't have variants, I would say absolutely yes. By the time we get all the over 65s, 90% of the deaths are in over 65s. And if we vaccinate all of those, then we've reduced hospitalizations and deaths. There will still be hospitalizations from younger people, but they're not as vulnerable as the older. And people with underlying medical conditions, all of those are going to be vaccinated pretty quickly. But the real issue that we have no real, we do have some angle on it yet, but we're not. There's no certainties around the variants.
Yeah.
The UK variant that emerged in Kent seems to be not an issue for the vaccines. There's a maybe small drop in efficacy against it, but that's not the case with the South African, Brazilian variants and a new variant that has emerged now in California, which is a recombination of two viruses. So these are worrying.
Is the San Francisco one of concern at this point? Yeah.
Yes, it is, very much so, because all of these three, the South African, Brazilian and the one in San Francisco, have a mutation in the virus spike protein, which is not in the UK Kent variant. So it's an additional mutation, which makes it tricky for the antibodies that are generated with the vaccines to neutralize it. Now, it doesn't stop it completely. It's just reduced. And if there were further mutations, which is inevitably going to happen, because that's what viruses do, then it may get further away from being able to be prevented by the vaccine. The good news is that
are you saying we have to get
versions of it, so we will be able to deal with it.
But do we have to? But in the meantime, do we have to get to so-called zero COVID or as close as possible before we can open up? Then is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
How far do you see that we need to get? Yeah. How far do you think we need to get, so?
I think, you know, I think we need to get to the situation, as was said, that we reduce significantly the numbers of cases in the community and we protect the vulnerable. And then if we have a trickle of cases in younger people that are not going to end up in hospital, it just becomes like any other infectious disease, like flu or mumps or measles that we deal with by vaccination on an annual basis. It's a little different from measles and mumps because they're not highly variable viruses, but it's a bit more akin to influenza, which is a variable virus. And we may have to have a booster vaccine every year for this going forward.
Can I ask a question there? So if we're concerned about the variants mostly, it's also in the paper today that 11,000 people a week are coming into the country by airplane. So would you be arguing in favour of a quarantine?
Absolutely. I mean, I've always argued.
Planes stopped from Italy a year ago. I remember talking to you about Kingston. Yeah,
exactly. You know, we a number of us have been saying this for over a year, and you know, it was slow enough to convince people that we need to regulate travel. But right now, it's imperative that we do it. I mean, you know, there's a very simple way of doing this, and the government have just complicated it. If you have ask everybody traveling into the country, not just from Brazil and South Africa, everybody to have the negative test and don't allow them on the flight unless you have a negative test. In the same way as you present your passport, you present your negative test. So it doesn't have to be regulated at the point of arrival, at the point of entry. That's the first thing. The second thing, when they arrive, they isolate for 5 days, mandatory, then have a test done. That's covering the period of 5 days plus the previous 2 days. It can get 99% of cases. 14-day quarantine is very tricky to implement, and I think 5 days is more doable for people. I mean, you saw in the Australian Open tennis, everybody that went there had to isolate for 14 days. And reading some of the blogs from those people who were isolating, they were going crazy after 14 days. I think you can handle five and be tested, and then you're you know, it's much more realistic than the 14-day quarantine.
Okay, that's an interesting new intervention in the whole thing. So some kind of halfway house that might be a bit more wearable.
Yeah, I mean, it's realism, you see. Yeah. I mean, the trouble is that if you ask people to do things that are just so difficult, then the compliance is going to be very low.
Yeah.
Whereas if you ask somebody to do something that's reasonable, the compliance level will be so much higher and people won't be breaking the rules then and they will buy into it. So it's getting the public behind you is critical on
meet
this.
Meet them halfway. Yeah. Lise, what do you think is going to be the real politique of how this is going to pan out in terms of that two-thirds who are going to start saying, as the old and vulnerable are done, we want to open up, whereas opening up could be disastrous?
Well, I mean, there's obviously tensions within the government parties, particularly because you've the backbench TDs and so on that are obviously getting it in the neck from constituents who are desperate to get businesses open, maybe get all their children back to school or whatever. So there's already a lot of pressure. The pressure is coming to that thing to open up again. I think what made that theory makes eminent sense is to I think fairness is key to getting people to remain compliant, because if people look at their 5K walks and then they're seeing planes coming in and, you know, people decanting and they don't know whether they have passports or not, that sense of unfairness is usually the thing that will unravel trust faster than anything else. So, I mean, if the government can't just say, we have to keep the clamps on, at the same time, heel drag about introducing whatever quarantine arrangements they have, I think that what Kingston suggests is eminently sensible. Doing something that's realistic as opposed to doing something that is just so punitive that people won't behave.
You're nodding along there, Rory. A sense of unfairness, yes.
When people perceive rules to be unfair or to be, you know, favouring one group over another, it's what drives people then to say, feck it, you know, what's the point? So all the way through the whole pandemic, from day one, the complaints you hear are nearly always rooted in a sense of unfairness. So I think it's vitally important that always it feels like everyone is being treated the same. And yeah, it certainly doesn't always feel like that at
yeah
the moment.
You see, unfortunately, Kingston, if we get into a situation where a lot of people are vaccinated and a lot of people aren't, we're not going to be treating everyone the same, are we? And are you on board with this notion of vaccine passports?
I don't like the word passport. I think it suggests people, you know, are safe somehow. I prefer the term certificate, and that's what the Danes, again, who are leading the charge on this, are using. They're using a digitalized certificate of vaccination. And Israel has a green pass, they call it. And so everybody in Israel who's been vaccinated is given this pass, or if you've recovered from COVID-19, which, you know, in my view and in their view, induces immunity, at least in the short term. And that's been used then as an entry into gyms, swimming pools, yeah, clubs, events, and the Danes are saying the same thing for travel, for sporting events, etc. If you've been vaccinated, you get the certificate, and then everybody that goes to those events are, you know, at least everybody around them they know are vaccinated, yeah, and they feel secure.
And everybody else, and everybody else can't go.
You don't go to the event, or you get vaccinated, yeah, if you have the option of getting vaccinated.
You know what we're actually going to do now is we are going to go to Israel, to James Rothwell, who is a Middle East correspondent of The Telegraph, and he is in Jerusalem. And I noticed that in Hugh O'Connell's piece in the Sunday Independent today, Stephen Donnelly was asked about Israel. He said it's certainly an approach we can think through. The emerging evidence on the impact of vaccines, etc., is encouraging, would lend itself to this way of thinking. So let's find out from James about this way of thinking. James, we'll try not to get jealous and we'll view this more as a hopeful glimpse of our own future. So now, Israel, as I remember, was in real trouble about just 3 weeks ago. We were hearing about how bad things were there. Vaccination has kind of changed everything. Are you getting your old lives back a bit?
Well, yes, the very, very fast vaccine drive in Israel has allowed them to lift some restrictions. And as one of your guests pointed out there, one of the sort of flagship programs for that is this Green Pass, which once you've had both doses of your vaccine, or once you've got proof that you've recovered from COVID, you can go to the gym, go to the swimming pool, go for a drink, that sort of thing. That said, the COVID cases in Israel still remains quite high despite all the vaccinations. That's being blamed on the emergence of new variants, such as the UK variant. So it's not quite as if things have really drastically improved in terms of the infection rate since the vaccine drive. But what has happened is that hospitalizations with COVID-19 has quite sharply decreased since the vaccination drive began. And that's what Israeli officials are saying is the strongest evidence that the vaccines are highly effective.
Okay, so have you got a green pass?
I don't know, because I've not yet been fully vaccinated, but I do know a few people who have got it, and they're very much enjoying going for a swim, going to lift some weights, and gradually returning to some semblance of daily life.
Okay, and in terms of the rest of you then, have you got a bit more freedom anyway in the last week or two, or is there anything else opening up for the unvaccinated?
Yes, because the ease in restrictions is not only for people who've got the green pass. So, for example, while you do need a green pass to go to the swimming pool or the gym, you don't need a green pass to go into, say, a shopping centre. And the shops, supermarkets, pharmacies, that sort of thing, have been open throughout the pandemic. So the green pass doesn't prevent you from sort of basic integration with society, if you like, but what it does give you access to is those perks, such as you know, going and doing some weights in the gym, such as going and swimming some lengths in the pool, or going for a few beers, that sort of thing. And that, in the Israeli view, creates a major incentive for people to get vaccinated as quickly as possible.
Yeah, our own deputy CMO has talked about the vaccine bonus, and I guess that sounds like the vaccine bonus there. Listen, in general, I know, look, Israel was not constrained by supply the way the rest of us were, but they were very, very kind of enthusiastic and energetic about getting vaccines out there, weren't they? And they brought them to the people, and or even out onto the streets. Like if they had done everyone in a building, they'd go onto the street and offer it to randomers passing by and stuff.
Yeah, that's right. The Israeli model for vaccines has been described here as sort of organized chaos, in the sense that you do have these very spontaneous sort of pop-up clinics appearing in the street. I was in a market last week, actually, and a sort of trailer just arrived in the middle of the market, and then within minutes this enormous queue had appeared behind it and people were getting vaccinated that way. There was a bar in Tel Aviv which started offering a free COVID vaccine along with a free non-alcoholic drink. So there has been these rather sort of ingenious methods that have been deployed to make sure that as many people as possible get a dose. And I think that along with very, very high public appetite for getting a vaccine is what's made this been so effective. Old people in Israel, for example, effectively were banned from leaving the house during much of the first, second lockdown. So I think a lot of people were just desperate to get their ticket, if you like, to some semblance of freedom.
Okay, James Rothwell in Jerusalem, thanks very much for that. Now, the thing is, I think that's one very sunny side of it, but it's not that simple either. And our near neighbours in the UK are having the vaccine passport discussion, but I think it's a bit more fraught over there, and a lot of people have a lot of issues with it. So Dawn Foster is a columnist with The Guardian, and she joins me now. Good morning, Dawn.
Good morning, how are you?
We got a very sunny view of the whole vaccine passport green card issue there from Jerusalem, but the conversation is a bit more fraught in the UK about the idea of bringing in vaccine passports, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, obviously, the rollout in Jerusalem and Israel has happened very, very fast. It's happening relatively quickly in England. I think a third of the country have had the first dose now. I had my first dose yesterday. But the issue here is that if you have the vaccine passport and you allow businesses to open a bit quicker and end lockdown a bit quicker, then businesses are only opening for a small number of the population, and you're essentially giving civil rights to a smaller number of the population, so older people, people like me who have health issues, and you're essentially giving the vast majority of the country, so people who don't have health issues, people who have, you know, children who have been cooped up for a long time, you're essentially asking them to stay cooped up, to not travel, and at the beginning of lockdown, we had badges issued by the government for people with health problems, saying that they didn't have to wear masks to stop them from being challenged if they went into shops, etc. And they were immediately copied and sold on eBay for people who didn't want to wear masks. So there is a worry that immediately people would try and pirate these and sell them on eBay. So you have the civil liberties issue, the fact that businesses may not want to open for a very small number of people, the fact that a large number of the population won't have these freedoms, and you will get a lot of people just copying them and selling fake passports on eBay.
Okay, and in a word, Dawn, do you think it's going to happen there soon?
I think it's very, very unlikely. It's
really?
Very, very unpopular. Left-wing newspapers, right-wing newspapers, it's unpopular with everybody. And because it won't affect the vast majority of the population, it's very, very unlikely to happen.
Okay, Dawn Foster of The Guardian, thank you for that. Sorry about that, folks, a bit of a more somber note on it all. Rory, can you see it happening? Can you see Panty Bar and Penny Lane opening up again and people coming in? And
well, I think she's right when she suggests that people would just be copying them. You know, we already have to deal with, you know, fake student IDs and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
So I think we'd just be adding another one to it. But I think Ireland is probably the country in the world that would have the most difficulties bringing that in, because we're so against any sort of, you know, that sort of stuff here. We don't even want, you know, an identity card.
Don't have these problems in Israel.
yeah, they don't.
Please, quickly, before we go to a break.
I was just thinking that possibly it might be end up as an organic thing that businesses will choose whether or not, and it'll be driven very much by public sentiment. If there is two coffee shops and one suddenly realises they're doing really well because all their staff are saying, I have vaccinated badges or whatever, it may very well be driven by sentiment. But I also think that perhaps they should look at bringing back the old, when you went and you know, gave blood, you got a free pint of Guinness. I mean, if they opened up the now bars and turned them into vaccination clinics and anybody got, you know, a free alcoholic drink when they got their vaccination, I don't know, I think there might be there might even be further take up, to be honest.
Absolutely.
With you.
I mean, they were encouraged by a non-alcoholic drink, yes, in Israel. They probably need to be something a little stronger in Ireland. Okay, our panel, Lise Hand, Rory O'Neill and Kingston Mills, staying with us. Let's take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Lise Hand, Rory O'Neill and Kingston Mills. Now, we touched on it there, but I said we'd come back to it properly because I think it is, it's across all the papers and it is a big thing on everyone's mind. And this is, of course, government communications and cohesion and so on. Lise, where do you want to start with that? Hugh O'Connell has a kind of a big, broad take on it in the Sunday Independent. What about Niamh Horan's piece in the Sunday Independent there with a PR guru?
Hugh Gallanders. Yes, he was one of the interesting things that they discussed in the piece is the possibility of bringing back the late lamented strategic communications unit that, of course, fell apart under the Leo Varadkar-led government. And the one thing that is very clear across all the papers and in all the kind of political pieces is that there is a feeling that there's a lack of communication. People are talking across purposes. Ministers are running with the hair, you know, and they're not sort of, you know, sticking to an agreed line, that nobody knows, you know, when things are happening. I mean, there's a wonderful quote at the very start of a piece by Aidan Corkery in the Sunday Business Post. And it's he quotes Pa Daly, who was elected for a TD in Kerry last year. And he said that the quote is basically, he says, I worked in the courts for years. And one thing I learned is that every prisoner likes to see a date on the door. And we feel like we're in remand at the moment. And in a way, I think it sums up brilliantly the fact that they have put out this pathway out, but it's lacking definite dates. It's lacking hope. It's lacking things that people can work to, as in definite things. I mean, obviously we know that it's, you know, the pandemic, we're at the mercy of different variants and how it might change the game. But at the same time, if people know that there are absolute definite dates to work to.
Or indeed data.
And data, yeah, to
people
work to.
People might accept data
and
rather
also,
than
you
dates.
Know, that crosses in another piece in Sunday Business Post talking about nursing homes. Like, all the nursing homes now are vaccinated. I have a personal interest in this. I have a close family member in residential care. And I haven't seen this family member since, you know, for 6 months now, a lot of the people involved in geriatric medicine are saying, you know, there needs to be a dividend to vaccination.
It's back to Ronan Glynn's vaccine bonus.
This is a vaccine bonus, exactly.
And the people in the nursing homes are the very first people who should be getting a vaccine bonus. They're the first vaccinated.
Our elderly are pioneers.
They do seem to be having the conversation about it now. And I think even Tadhg Daly was saying, we're not looking to open today, but we want a plan here over
But
the
I mean,
next,
they should be, the, you know, the elderly should be the pioneers. They're the ones that got the first jabs. They should be the ones that show the way, that, you know, say, look, this is the reward. This is what happens. It's a physical thing that people can get hold of, in among all the nebulous talk about, you know, variants, we can't do this and we're not sure. This is something they can actually say, everybody is vaccinated. Now we can start with proper care, letting people back in to see their loved ones and so on. So people can say, right, okay, now I see an actual physical positive thing out of this vaccination. So they needs to be more milestones like this. And this is very much, you know, Hugh Gallanders did talk about this and talked about the fact that there needs to be a sort of one strategic communication decision.
But it was such a simple thing he said, but it really hit me when he said the government needs to be talking with one voice.
They do.
And Rory, do you share this frustration that, you know, depending on which radio programme you tune into, and look, I'm not blaming the media, they will ask the questions, like that's what they'll do, but everyone seems to feel the need to answer the question off the top of their heads at times.
Well, you know, what absolutely drives me mad is the sort of the flying of kites from different, you know, ministers, or leaks from meetings, because that, you know, the casual aside is what will keep a small business owner like me awake all night. I want clear, simple delivery of what they know, and everybody else shut up. Like, there's a great little quote from John Drennan's article in the Mail today. And he goes, one source said, there's no maestro, or perhaps more accurately, an enforcer. Politicians need a rule of terror if they are to behave. And I think that's what's missing in government buildings at the moment.
At least we did see during the week that Fionnán Sheehan, I think, was reporting that the Minister for Health refused to go on primetime on Tuesday night, maybe after Clare Byrne on Monday night, right? And that eventually they cast around, they got Jack Chambers to win. But John Drennan's suggesting there's a strike on among ministers who are saying, I'm not going in to be eyeballed by presenters asked to tell them stuff when I'm not being told stuff myself and I didn't have anything to do with this non-strategy.
Absolutely, but it's not the first time we've seen senior ministers run for ground when the going gets tough. It's the junior ministers that get going to the various studios. We've seen that, we saw during things like the bank crash and so on like that. You quite often found it hard to find ministers that would come out to give a line. And then, of course, when they did, it was often, as we saw with the famous nodding, the two nodding dogs around the times of when there was a question with the IMF or coming in. And there was huge mixed messages there. They need to sort this out. The ministers need to be given clear instructions to, A, stay within their lines and not, there's no point having one minister coming out and making pronouncements on somebody else's patch because that doesn't lead anyone anywhere. And there's an interesting piece in Hugh O'Connell's piece in the Sunday Independent today. He talks very much about various dissent and so on within the parliamentary party meetings, which, of course, are always merrily leaked to the waiting political correspondents. But, he quotes one backbencher who was saying that there's a lot of fear among the backbenchers that when Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael candidates go and knock on doors, whenever they start knocking on doors again, I suppose that's been one of the blessings of the pandemic is that they haven't had politicians on your door, but that they're all afraid now that everybody will look at them and go, you're all the same and we're not in government and so on.
So there's a struggle for them to keep their own identities going on here.
Yeah, to keep that identity. So that's sort of feeding into the general confusion. Yeah. Some people afraid to open their mouths and some shooting off their mouths. But there's right. I mean, it was the famous PJ O'Mara who did the Una Vote Una Duce about Charlie Hoy.
On that note, Rory, did you have an idea, I think, that the Taoiseach should just come on once a week kind of fireside chat and just tell us where we're at?
My feeling is they need to just stop all the leaking and all of the discussing possibilities, with political correspondents. And, once a week, have the Taoiseach come out and tell us what he actually knows and what they can actually say. And I accept that this is a difficult situation and that the numbers change and new variants arrive and so on. So I accept that and understand that. But we need one clear voice telling us exactly what they know and no less and no more.
There is something appealing about a fireside chat once a week, just telling us everything, isn't there? Kingston, what do you think about the communications around this and around the government?
I think the public are fed up with being preached at, and I wouldn't blame them. I mean, we're all fed up being locked up, first of all, but being preached at in particular. And I think the sort of nightly briefing, being told you've got to do this, you've got to do that, is probably too frequent. And I think, that maybe should morph into a weekly briefing where people are giving the full, clear, unambiguous facts about where we are, rather than saying you should do this, you should do that. It should be more you should do this because, and if you don't, this is the consequence. And rather than sort of saying, every night you've got to do better, you've got to do better, because people just give up on it. And that's the problem.
Yeah, I think we should say, in fairness to Neffet, and a few people have mentioned this, that if you tune in around 5:30 on Thursday on the RT News Now channel, that once weekly Neffet briefing, you always get a lot at that. And the questions from the journalists afterwards are all very interesting as well. Yeah. And I think it does give us as much of a picture as we get. And Philip Nolan gives a good picture and all that. So that's the Thursday briefing. Rory, I'm very struck by what you said there about loose lips keeping you up all night. One little thing, and I've seen you're in the Sunday Indo today talking about that. And I think there's a guy from Cork, somewhere called the Idaho Cafe that I don't know. And he says today in a piece in the Business Post, I feel that the government has pushed us off a cliff and forgotten about us. And I feel, you know, there's this notion that, oh, and there's even texts coming in there now, we haven't been hearing from hospitality recently because of what they did at Christmas and all this. But in a way, I think we have forgotten about you guys a little bit in the last few weeks. And I think we forget as well that there are people's lives here, and that all this stuff, as much as it's a pain in the ass to a lot of people, this stuff is much more real to you.
Well, I think the piece in the Sunday Business Post is actually great. And there's a one of the first paragraphs in it is, you know, about a cafe owner who is going in every week to flush the toilets and, you know, turn on the heating for a bit to keep the building in shape. And the sort of the pain she feels when she sees the wallpaper is peeling off the wall. I so get that, because it's absolutely crushing to pass by Panty Bar and the lights are all off. There's dust gathering on things. Because I don't know, you know, people who maybe haven't ever owned a small business, you know, it's like a baby to you. You've poured so much of your time, your energy, your psychic energy, everything into it. And at times you're struggling so hard, you know, it's a really hard thing to do. And in our case, we opened 6 months before the crash. So, you know, the first 5 years was fighting tooth and nail for survival. And so they've gone through all that and they now be in a position where your hands are tied and you're not allowed to fight for its survival. That is incredibly hard to deal with. And then what there is that sense that it was decided we're closing the bars and the restaurants and all that. And I'm not arguing against that. I'm not a COVID denier. I understand why we're closed. But it feels like there was the decision made, we're closing that, and then they think, well, that's that question sorted, and they've potted on to the next thing. But the people in those industries are expected to take on a much larger burden than the rest of the population. We are also dealing with all the things that everybody else is dealing with, not being able to go to funerals and not being able to celebrate things in groups and all of that stuff. But on top of that, we've had our economic lives just totally, you know, decimated.
Yeah.
And that's an extra thing. Yeah. And there is this feeling that once the decision was made to close the bars and restaurants, that everyone just skipped on ahead and hasn't really, you know, considered what's that doing to 30% of the population. People in live events, people in bars and restaurants, people in performance. You know, it's really devastating. And it's been a year now. And the longer it goes on, the harder it is to sit there and watch your business gather dust.
Yeah, and I'm conscious for you as well that there's another level to this maybe, and forgive me now if this is wrong, but like, I suppose, okay, those of us who have a family at home, we have all that situation. You don't strike me as a domestic cat, if you will. You're more, I won't say an alley cat, but you're a boulevardier. Your life is more out there. It's you're an extrovert, sociable, feeding off people. Yeah.
That's going into my Twitter bio. It is. You know, like, there are some people for whom actually the lockdown sort of suits them. I mean, you know, I accept it's hard for everybody, but some people actually like to spend all day Saturday making a lovely big dinner for the, you know, for that evening of fancy dinner. Some people like to go walking on the beach, you know, every day, you know, within their 5K, whatever. It's sort of, that's partly there, you know, I think probably, you know, they're middle-aged or whatever. I don't know. But imagine if you were 21 and you're living in some, like, I think back at some of the flats I lived in when I was 21, and the thought of having to spend a whole 24 hours.
It was
hours
a place
there,
to sleep, basically,
oh my
God,
and having to spend a year in it, I would be absolutely clawing my way up the walls. Or even having to go home to lovely mammy and daddy. They're lovely mammy and daddy, but when you're 21 or 22, a whole year without going to a bloody party or anything, like, people are going up the walls, and it is harder for some people than others.
Yeah, I'll bring in the others in a second. One more question for you. I was interested, you said in that piece in the Indo today that you were never somebody who had mental health issues.
Mm.
You kind of didn't know that you actually got depressed, but you didn't know what it was because it was so off your radar.
Yeah, in the last
thing.
Year, especially in the last sort of 6 months, I think, as it's gotten harder and longer. And, you know, if I had been watching me from the outside, you know, if it had been a friend, I would have immediately recognized it as depression. But because in my 52 years of life, it's just never been part of my, you know, mental landscape. I'm not that personality. So it actually took me a long time to recognize depression in myself. Because of course I got depressed. Of course I did. Hmm. I've been locked into an apartment for a whole year with zero income and zero ability to fight for my working life. You know, I'm not allowed to go in and try stand-up comedy nights or whatever it is you do, like, you know, during the crash when you were just fighting tooth and nail to survive. At least you could try things and do things and innovate and change and, you know, fight for the business. Whereas in the in this case, yeah. I'm not even allowed to do that.
And you know, just the thing, like, apparently if you're in a car accident, right, and if you can do something to get yourself out of the car, you won't be traumatized. But if you can't do anything to get yourself out of the car, that's when you're traumatized for life, that powerlessness. And that's what you feel right now, powerlessness.
Absolutely,
about it. Do you think your industry, which is a lot of young people, a lot of low-paid people, and a lot of quirky kind of people as well, and people who put their lives, you know, chose a different way of life, really. You're a tribe apart in a way.
Yeah.
Are we looking at a massive, massive epidemic of mental health issues among all those people?
I think in my industries, yes. I mean, I talk to any of my friends in the, you know, in the nightlife, entertainment, hospitality business, and they all are going through the same things. It's been really, the longer it goes on, the more I realize how hard it has been. I think because we're living at home and we're getting up and having dinner and, you know, the usual things, we're like, we're not in a war with a gun in our hand. At first, I kind of felt, oh, this is an easy thing, you know, because on the surface it looks easy. But the longer it's gone on, the more I realize how difficult it has been.
That is probably the most enlightening contribution that I've heard in this debate in a while. Kingston Mills, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think people have underestimated the mental side of the mental health side of lockdown. But also another related argument to this is the consequence for people with, which we haven't talked about, but it's incredibly important, for, medical conditions that are unrelated to COVID-19 who can't get to hospital for treatment. So this is something that, you know, is going to have huge repercussions for months and years to come, the people who haven't been screened for diseases and the consequence. So, we you know, it's the tip of the iceberg of what the consequences are in the longer term for a lot of people's health.
Yeah.
So it's not just, and mental health is one aspect, but actually other aspects of health as well.
And look, an extraordinary costs, but I just thought, at least, that that we have in a way tend to forget and block out that there are so many Rorys all over the country in different ways, and that's what they're going through.
I mean, absolutely, and I think this that's almost what Rory just said. I think it almost encompasses everything we've talked about for the last hour. It's about people feeling, certainly we go back to the thing of fairness, that everybody's in it together, and if it adds to it, if somebody if groups feel that they've been left out and their voices haven't been heard, you know, there's a piece in the Business Post about a group of businesses want to, you know, pedestrianise Merrion Row. Businesses are desperately trying to find a way to to live with this, to deal with this. And I think it goes back to the government as well. The two things that the Taoiseach has to do is give facts and give hope, because give people dates that they can work to foster that sense of that we're all in this together, which is broken down somewhat. But give people hope as well. I mean, you know, the fact that we are a year on, we have vaccines, is extraordinary, and they are extraordinary, and their efficacy is amazing. We should be, you know, there should be more awareness of just how amazing this is. By the old rules, we could have been not looking at a vaccine for 4 or 5 years. So, you know, this is great. But give people hope. Say, look, you know, things are going to get better. They are, you know, they're, you know, we will get through this, but not just with fuzzy talk. Just say, and here's how we're going to get through it. This is going to happen and this is going to happen. But you have to give people hope.
Yeah. Mm. OK, let's give people hope. We've a couple of minutes left. Rory,
yes.
You picked out a great story about Paddy McKillen's chateau in France in the Sunday Times, which it's on my list. I don't like France as a rule, but I've been planning to go there for a while. Just tell us a little bit. Transport us off.
Well, you know, I live within a stone's throw and work within a stone's throw of the Jervis, you know, Street Shopping Centre. So Paddy McKillen looms large in my daily experience of life. But I actually was ignorant of the fact that he's a huge art lover, and he has this chateau in France with a huge art park associated with it. And it has some beautiful buildings to display all the art. And he's just had an amazing looking new building built by Richard Rogers, the famed architect. So there's a whole other facet to Paddy that I wasn't aware of.
Oh, this place sounds extraordinary. Yeah. There's a Frank Geary Pavilion there, yes, and I think he makes his own
Enzo
wine
Piano,
there.
Everybody, the list of names.
You can go and stay there, and you can eat there and all kinds of things. Yeah, it's called Chateau Lacoste. So go off now, and when this show is over, go off and Google that and think about your pandemic travels in the future.
Well, the new building is tipping over a cliff.
It looks incredible, doesn't it?
You wouldn't get me into that for love nor money. Yeah.
Do you know what? I'm sure Richard Rogers got a good engineer on that one, you would hope.
Absolutely.
And listen, Lise, we have a minute for a bit of Luke O'Neill and a bit of looking
Sunshine
after
Luke,
ourselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sunshine
so
Luke,
this is getting ourselves ready for vaccination.
Getting vaccine ready. So he goes into all the various things, that you should do, like get a good night's sleep beforehand, and because good night's sleep will help your immune system kick into place. Take vitamin D. And it's interesting because of all the disinformation spreading around vitamin, the snake oil stuff about vaccines and whatever, vitamin D has come out as something that is actually good to take. It helps and build your immune system. So, it's a great piece because it kind of reminds people the vaccine is on the way.
And also it's something we can do that's within our power.
That.
Actually, we've 30 seconds. Kingston Mills, should we all be taking vitamin D? D3, is it?
D3. I mean, certainly if you're older and you have, osteoporosis-like problems, vitamin D is essential, especially if you're not going out and getting the sunshine, because the sunshine is what generates vitamin D in our body. So if you're low on calcium and you have bone issues, you should really take vitamin D. But it's also been shown to have some positive influences on preventing the inflammation associated with COVID-19. So it certainly won't hurt to take vitamin D.
Super. Okay. Listen, Kingston Mills, thank you very much. And thank you so much to Rory O'Neill and Lise Hannon.